Today on Movie Rollers, we're going to review Boyhood, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and Snowpiercer. It's time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And yes, you as well.
Movie Rollers is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Hello, everybody.
Good morning.
Hello.
This is a recording from Yazdi's house.
We're on location.
Early, early morning.
Yes, I'm sorry.
It is for you, Yazdi.
It's only 10:15 on a Sunday morning.
It's we're doing Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, not Night of the...
We were literally sat outside Yazdi's house for a couple of minutes hearing crash banging running down the stairs as we arrived. So Yazdi, what time did you get up this morning?
I actually woke up at 8:30, but then I was speaking with my sister, I was on the phone, I was in the car.
Sunday morning stuff.
Well, it's good to be here. We haven't recorded here for ages, so we've got a portable recording solution, which makes things a little more flexible, which is good.
Yeah, I think it frees us up. It untethers us.
We can record anywhere.
We can record anywhere.
Actually, we should ask people if they want us to come and record at their house. We'll come and record at their house.
No, imagine we're going to get... No, I don't want to do that.
That would be fun.
Yeah, it would be fun. It could be a thing. Yeah. For a minimal charge, $11.
Yeah. $11 to have all three of us come to your house and record with you.
No.
Okay.
Have you ever been on the phone with a friend and you suddenly hear the toilet flushing?
No.
It's happened to me.
No. What do you mean, Rashmi? No. You're the biggest culprit.
No, that's what I was going to say. I'm usually the culprit, but I only do it with my family.
It's ridiculous.
I never do it with friends.
I'm like, I never want to be that comfortable with anyone that somebody's peeing while they're talking to me.
You know, sometimes you just got to go. Yeah, Joe's horrified that I'm able to talk on the phone.
Well, I just,
but you gotta go. You gotta go when you gotta go.
Yeah, I know. I can't imagine what my dad's reaction would be if I was talking away to him and then suddenly.
But we could literally be doing a podcast while we're peeing.
Not all of us together.
All of us at once. Yes.
We would all have to be in separate locations.
That would be a budcast.
A podcast. Yeah. Okay. We're talking like monkeys.
Yes, we are. So before we get into that, we should talk about Wrangle.
Yes.
We have a new partnership with a group of guys over at the company Wrangle, RANGL.com. Great bunch of guys. We first met with them during South by Southwest a couple of years ago, and we've been interacting with them ever since. But we're working with them to set up a movie while a specific Wrangle. And if you don't know what a Wrangle is, it's basically a way to online debate. So we'll be asking questions during the podcast, and we just encourage everyone to head over to. I'll put a link straight in the show notes, and you can head over there, click the link, and then you can debate our question of the week. So we'll do our question of the week at the end of the podcast. But looking forward to giving just another way to interact with the Movie Rollers.
Yeah, and Wrangle the site is wonderful. It's a really cute site, and not only can you debate about movie, you can debate about anything. So you have an argument with your friend and you say the price of milk is going up and I can't stand it. Should milk be that expensive? Well, you can set up a wrangle with that person or other people and you get justice points. Other people who belong to Wrangle start to weigh in on your debate. So our hope is that we can create this community of film debates as well as all of the other debates. So Wrangle, RANGL.com. Great site. And we'll be setting up some wrangles with every podcast. And we hope to interact with everyone and finally know that I am always right.
All right, well, let's get into our review. First one is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. So, Yazdi, I think. No, Rashmi is introing this.
Yes, I am. So this comes 3 years after the original Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which I was quite surprised about. I thought Rise of the Planet of the Apes just happened. But anyway, it was 2011. So now the story takes us 10 years forward, and this is a growing nation of genetically evolved apes led by Caesar, who we met in Rise, is threatened by a band of human survivors of the devastating virus unleashed the decade earlier. So they reach a fragile peace but it proved short-lived as both sides are brought to the brink of a war that will determine who will emerge as Earth's dominant species. So this is directed by Matt Reeves, and it's written by Rick Jaffa, Amanda Silver, and Mark Bomback. And it stars Jason Clarke, Gary Oldman, Kerry Russell, Cody Smith-McPhee, and Kirk Acevedo, who I was really happy to see, who used to be in Oz. Great actor. Judy Greer and Andy Serkis is Caesar. And then there's lots of other people playing some of the apes. So,
and did you mention Gary Oldman?
I did mention Gary
Sorry,
Oldman.
Sorry, I missed that. Okay.
So who wants to go first? Yazdi.
So there are many people I know who never, ever give more than 2 out of 4 stars to movies. And those individuals have been giving the movie 4 stars, this one. Certain critics we know here in San Diego, the movie's running in excess of 95%. I haven't checked recently, but it's running more than 95%.
I think it was 91 as of this morning. So
it's still a pretty admirable 91% on the tomato meter, on Rotten Tomatoes, and all of which seems, frankly, very, very surprising to me, because to me, this was a very, very average film. Very average. And I know I'm going to be the sole minority. Everybody's going to go, what? But I don't know. The apes from these movies do not do much for me. The earlier reboot with James Franco did not do much for me. And I think it's just a question of connection. I just do not connect with any of this. But it's gorgeous to look at. It's entertaining, but very average.
Joe.
To which I say, yes, the big raspberry like one of the monkeys did in the movie. Unlike, I think, the two of you, I really got a lot out of the original prequel, The Rise of the Planet of the Apes, that came out a couple of years ago. And I remember I missed that screening originally, and you guys kind of gave the movie a bit of a hard time. So I was disappointed, because it was a franchise that I have a lot of fondness for and was hoping to get a lot from. And I did enjoy that movie. I think had I reviewed it on the show, it would probably gotten, you know, like an 8 or 9, even perhaps a 9 out of 10. This one, for me, just takes everything I liked about that first one and escalates it up. It's one of my favorite movies of the summer so far. I don't know how they could have done this particular version of the story any better. Yes, there's a little bit of a leap you have to make with talking apes, but this is Planet of the Apes, and so if you know the franchise, you get over that pretty quickly. But there are so many wonderful themes in this movie. There are themes of family. There's the themes of ecology. There are the themes of war. There are themes of personalities and betrayal. And everything is just handled so brilliantly well that to me, this was close to perfection. This is as good a movie as I could have hoped this one to be. And maybe I'm being swept along with all of the hyperbole out there about this movie, but boy, did I have a good time at the movies with this.
So I was like Yazdi, I didn't actually love Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and so I wasn't that excited to see this one. But I have to say, I was blown away. Joe, I'm in your camp right from the first frame of the movie. This was epic and beautiful. I mean, the cinematography was just amazing, Yazdi, like you say. There's this amazing scene right at the start where we see upwards a bunch of monkeys jumping through the trees. Phenomenal. Someone took note of all of the things that were not great in the first movie and tried to correct each one. I love this movie. And like you, Joe, I think this is one of my favorite movies of the summer so far.
So, Yazdi, why did you have such a hard time with this? Is it the uncanny valley of the monkeys?
No, it's not that I had a hard time. It was very, very entertaining. And absolutely, the movie is gorgeous to look at. It's visually beautifully conceived. I mean, there are some amazing action scenes in the movie. There are shots which even now I'm wondering how they went about doing it, short of using just green screen right off the bat. I mean, there's some pulling away of the camera through all kinds of stuff. So it's visually beautiful. It's just that I cannot get past giggling at the apes. They always seem so artificial. I understand the whole...
So it is an uncanny valley thing, right? It's a visual thing. They don't look real to you. You can't buy them.
It's not. It's more than that. It's not just visually. I don't believe them. And I understand. I understand the whole franchise is meant to be about any group of disenfranchised individuals who are thought of as being lesser than the other humans. That's the whole, you know, allegory of the Planet of the Apes. Even the first one about revolt and about treating those who are less than you with kindness. I get all that, but it never really registers for me. And I think for this one, the thing which really undid things for me was the dialogue. The dialogue is really clunky.
What?
Really? I mean, there's so much of apes, not friend of humans. enemy of ape is enemy of human. Because I mean, you're not supposed to laugh at this.
This is the beginning of a civilization, right? And these are, they aren't purported to be equal in any way to humans in terms of their intelligence. I think this is supposedly their kind of, you know, the missing link human kind of thing, where there's something between human and, you know, mm-hmm. apes. They're kind of in that middle bit. So language is a new thing. Remember, this movie is set only 10 years after the original, and this is a group of apes that escaped from a lab. So the rudimentaries of society and language are very basic for them, and they're developing that.
Yeah, but don't let me. I fully realize I'm the.
You're the monkey in the situation.
I'm the monkey in the situation. So I don't want to drag the whole discussion down. I mean, I know everybody is. This movie has really affected everyone, and people really think very highly of it.
Yeah, and I think, Yazzie, given I was on your side of the fence, and now I've defected to the other side, I think my favorite thing about this movie was, you know, whereas in the first one we had a lot of the lab chemical type situation, which I didn't like at all. My favorite thing about this movie is the whole way through I was thinking, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? Who am I rooting for? Am I rooting for the humans or am I rooting for the apes? And it kept changing. It kept changing all the way through. One minute I was rooting for the humans, one minute I was rooting for the apes. That whole question of good versus evil, it was so incredible. And then the genius of this movie is that it's such a good telling of the impact of power and corruption. And it's a very human story played out by apes. I mean, it's just incredible. And that bit really won me over.
Yeah, I mean, clearly for me, the apes are the heroes of the story. I mean, it's about them. It's set in their world. And this is really centered around the lead ape, Caesar. But the humanity of it is what I think you were alluding to. And I totally agree with that point. I mean, I think one of the things that I really liked about this movie is it's essentially it becomes a bit of a battle movie, right? You know, towards Act Three, you have this big conflict. But the build-up towards it was very cleverly done because, as is often the case with war, it's the result of not necessarily two leaders that are clashing. It's the politics and the subtexts and the undertones and the personal prejudices of the warmongers that ends up leading to the tipping point. And to me, that was a really nicely done thing, because this could have been a very easy kind of monkey versus human kind of clash. But instead, you get a somewhat cerebral plot for a action movie where you have lots of hidden agendas that play out over time. And, you know, you have the wisdom of the leaders who are really trying to, you know, avert war. But there are, you know, powerful forces that are trying to subvert that process. And, you know, it sounds very kind of hoity-toity for what is an action movie, but it was really nicely done. I enjoyed how cleverly that plot developed. And like you, Rashmi, I mean, I think there are no rights and wrongs. Everything's shades of grey here, right? Mm-hmm. And this is one of the beauties in my mind of the writing. You know, were the humans right to do what they did? Were the apes right to do what they did? You know, this is just a very interesting premise on which to base the story. So I don't know. I clicked with all of that. It was very much to me like, I'm going to draw comparisons to Dark Knight, but remember some of the ambiguities that were present all the way through Dark Knight as, you know, the Batman versus Joker thing. I love that kind of conflict where everything's kind of chaotic and there's no absolute rights or wrongs in any of the sides.
I think Christopher Nolan is one of the overrated directors in Hollywood. But still, I think it's leagues apart. I think, you know, the Batman movies are so much more complex and so much more complicated and layered. This one seemed a little too pat all along. Like, you know, Gary Oldman's character is, you know, the warmonger from his end. And then, you know, the Korba character is the warmonger from the apes. And I don't know, it didn't seem sophisticated to me.
Really?
And, you know, and Jason Clarke, who plays the lead, he didn't register at all. Poor Kerry Russell. I mean, she only thing she has to do is just be like the supportive person hanging around on the side saying, you can do this, you can do this. I don't know.
Really?
It just came off shallow.
See, for me, Jason Clarke and Kerry Russell was such, it was such a good choice to replace James Franco and Fredo Pinto, because their acting was so bad in the last one that it almost, I think that contributed to my low score. Jason Clarke and Kerry Russell, I thought, brought a real humanity, and they felt very credible and believable without looking too fragile and ridiculous. So I thought that was a really good choice to bring them in, but maybe I was just comparing against James Franco and Frida Pinto, which was such a low bar that anything would have been better. I agree with you, Yazdi, though. Gary Oldman's character was a little bit caricaturist, in my opinion.
Well, I'll tell you, the piece which played really well was the one about their son. So,
yes.
You know, about that was played with the kind of delicacy I wish the rest of the movie had, you know, had played with. It didn't kind of hammer things out. You know, his whole... whole arc was handled very well.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to argue about the other characters because I think you're both wrong. But the thing that I thought was really well done here was Andy Serkis. Mm-hmm. If you go on YouTube, and I actually recommend anyone do this and look for Andy Serkis behind the scenes, Planet of the Apes, you can see the kind of thing that he does and exactly how closely the CG Caesar mimicked the performance that we see on screen, right. And the performance that he did. And honestly, all of the big moments in this movie were done facially and physically by Caesar the Ape, that I just think there needs to be some sort of... I mean, how do you recognize? What are we seeing here? Is it a visual performance? Is it a physical performance? There needs to be almost a separate Oscar category. If you're not going to recognize this type of performance in the Academy Awards, which I think there was talk about previously, but it never came through... There needs to be some other category for this type of acting, because what he does with this character physically and facially is remarkable. And, you know, props to the CG artists who then layer upon that to create something that we have that's very, very believable. But I was blown away by every moment that Caesar the Ape had. You know, he had some big speeches, and yes, Yazdi, they were all broken ape, not want war, you know, but I believed them. I totally bought them.
Yeah.
And that could have gone so horribly wrong.
But I agree with Yazdi that at times the CG is a little bit irritating, especially when you see the apes jumping. That's the problem I had with the first one. But it does feel a little bit better in this one. But the thing that then, again, won me over was there feels like there's a great deal of thought that's gone into the movie. I mean, there's an incredible tension all the way through. I mean, I was just so tense all the way through. I think I had anxiety. But we've seen a lot of dystopian Earths recently in a lot of films. And they just look like they're completely blown up cities. You know, you see Chicago ruined. You see New York ruined. For me, seeing the San Francisco, which was kind of broken down but overgrown, little things like that, it's very thoughtful. It's not just lazy. How ominous and scary the apes look when they're riding on their horses as an army. You know, that whole sort of starting to show the hierarchy and that order of civilization, I guess, in a group of animals. That was amazing. And then there was this incredible emotionality between the apes that we didn't necessarily see as much of in the first one because it was the rise of the apes, you know, they were escaping. So now that they've all settled into their home for the last 10 years, I guess that emotionality, the civilization they've created, the tribe, that was amazing to me. I mean, just incredible. Okay. Anything else on this one?
I could talk about this for hours, but we should look towards wrapping it up. So
Joe, why don't you go first? We'll do a sandwich of Yazdi.
I thought this was spectacular. I mean, this is everything that I hoped it would be. It really does a great respect to the original franchise. I think they take a lot of the ideas that we see developing in the Planet of the Apes type scenario, and they seed them. They start to seed them. And I think that's what a good prequel should be. And this is also a sequel, and they took everything that I thought was good about Rise of the Planet of the Apes and, you know, the characters. And we saw the next step in that transition. So as far as sequels go, you know, this is as much as I could have hoped for. I totally love this movie. I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. And, you know, that may only increase because I really, really, really love this movie.
Yes.
Yeah. So as I said at the start, this franchise has absolutely no resonance for me. I mean, I for whatever reason, it doesn't connect with me at all. It always just looks silly. CGI or men wearing monkey suits, it just all seems it just doesn't emotionally register. And I want to be clear, I mean, this is not a bad film at all. It's exceptionally entertaining and it's beautiful to look at visually. It just did not move anything within me at all. So it's a good film. It's just not great. And I have great respect for this director, Matt Reeves, who did the English version last of Let the Right One In and did an amazing job with that. So I give it 5 out of 10.
Hmm.
Boo.
Okay, so this is one of the most intelligent movies I've seen all summer so far, which is multi-layered. It's political without hitting you over the head with a mallet as it does so. For a time, it all goes ape, and we see guerrilla warfare at its best. But clearly, this is the dawn of an incredible movie, and we are so set up for a third. I can't wait. I actually felt like I felt coming out of The Empire Strikes Back, which was a brilliant sequel, and this is a brilliant sequel, and I give this one an 8 out of 10.
I've seen that comparison made, and
Oh, really?
Yeah, online, and I totally get that. I mean, I think that's a very valid... it augments everything that was there in the first, that you hoped the first could be. So, yeah, good stuff. Should we stick with the sci-fi theme and move on to Snowpiercer?
Mm-hmm.
We should.
Okay, so, Yazdi.
Yes, so Korean director Jun Ho Bong, the man behind The Host from 2006 and The Amazing Mother, which was nominated for Best Foreign Film in 2009, has created his most ambitious film, Snowpiercer, which was a great critical and commercial success in Korea and around the world in 2013. And for some strange, odd reason, I guess we should blame Harvey Weinstein, it arrives in the US a full year later in 2014. What we have again here is a future world where things have gone terribly wrong. Everyone on the planet has been killed, and the only survivors are on a train that circles around the Earth indefinitely. Inevitably, a class system develops within the train, between those with power and those without it, and a full-out war erupts on the train called the Snowpiercer. The film stars Chris Evans, Jamie Bell, John Hurt, Octavia Spencer, Alison Pill, and the inimitable Tilda Swinton. This was by far my most anticipated movie of 2014
up
until July, purely based on this director and the previews I had seen. So I'm eager to know what you guys
And it was the opening film at LA Film Festival
as
well.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. Yeah, that was a big, huge opening, which we couldn't get to, frustratingly. But.
Yeah. So I think this is an interesting movie or social commentary about the human condition and humanity generally, you know, and again, we just talked about this with Planet of the Apes, you know, how humans are good at organizing themselves, fair or not, and creating hierarchy and structure. It has so much promise to start with, and it's a well-made movie that keeps you with it until the very end, where it all went terribly wrong for me. So I came away thinking, WTF, the end just didn't justify the means, and so I was really disappointed, and I ended up walking out feeling like I wasted my time. I loved the beginning, I hated the end, and so I ended up not loving the movie.
So, I mean, this is set in a dystopian Hunger Games style universe, right? You have the whole class system that, you know, the Hunger Games have. In Hunger Games, they use districts, and in many other sci-fi, you know, they have this same idea of this class type warfare thing. And I think it's just a high concept sci-fi film that for me came in as slightly above mediocre. I mean, I think it has the makings of a cult hit, and I can see why people who like it love it. But ultimately, it came off as a little bit of a video game for me, where you had these ascending levels of difficulty as they progress through the train. And it was literally level by level by level by level until you get to the end where this big, you know, in video game language, you have a boss fight, you know, where there's this big, you know, huge thing that you have to accomplish in order to complete the game. And so it just came off as that kind of very forced sci-fi premise. You know, I didn't buy the whole, you know, the train is the only thing living on the earth because everything else is frozen. I had a hard time with it. So with that said, Yazdi probably loved this one. Let's see what you thought.
I kind of think this movie is akin to that kid in class that nobody thinks much of, you know, or pays much attention or any attention to in class. And then that kid goes around to top the entrance exams in college and you go him. And I think in this summer of, you know, kind of mostly bland, empty action films, this is an action film which has a vision. It's a vision which is slightly off kilter, very off kilter. And I had a big problem with the last act of the movie as well, and I'll come to that in a minute. But I just like that it's so ambitious and it's so well realized, and it doesn't feel like it's been put together by 100 writers. It doesn't feel like, you know, it has been through test screenings and they've changed it to adapt to the test screening, even when it goes horribly, horribly deranged at the end. And this was the issue I had. It just goes stark crazy at the end.
Exactly.
Like really stark crazy. It goes beyond dark, darker than dark, just mad crazy. Even then, it is one person's vision. I got a sense of, it had a stamp of individuality and originality that movies don't have. Even something like X-Men feels like, It's been through the grinder, and as witty and well realized as it is, it has the paws of 100 people on it. This had a uniqueness of vision, which I really admire.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I agree with you, Yazdi. I mean, I have such a hard time with this movie, and I actually will rate it in two parts because I think it's two different movies. I think the first two thirds, the first two acts are brilliant. I mean, amazing directing, you know, because not only did this movie manage to evoke a lot of emotion in me, but it was an incredible range of emotion. I mean, for me, it went from heartbreaking to sinister to scary, like a horror, because I was literally grieving for these people who are on the train, because the world that they're living in is so useless and hopeless and painful and hurtful for them. And then on the other side, you have this, you know, stress that you feel from all the violence and all of the sinister things that are going on around them and the controlling. And it's so unique and novel, and it's well thought out. And you know, we get a little bit of exposition about how the train came to be, but we get it from a little kid's video that's playing in like a school cart. I mean, it's just some of its genius, and then the end just completely ruined it.
Well, to speak to its originality, because I don't feel that it's a very original premise at all. I mean, I think we've seen this type of, you know,
it's Hunger Games for adults. I agree.
No, but in terms of vision, well, the train is just, you know, it's just some container in which these people have to live. So it could be the radioactive wasteland. It could be the city walls. It could be, it's just a forced premise. It's like, well, no one's done a train before, so why don't we try a train? Because then we can have these segregation by carriage, almost by section of the train. And so for me, it just felt very forced and fake. And some compartments in that train were just totally out there. I mean, you know, you had like the disco compartment where everyone was like drugged up and, you know, but it was just weird, right? And I think to me, it was just overly forced as a sci-fi premise. So I'm a little tired as well of this kind of steampunk, you know, does anyone know what steampunk is? Yeah. But I'm a little tired of that kind of steampunk industrial rags dystopia. I think it's very boring. We've had it since the 80s. And this movie actually, I think, would have done well in the type of sci-fi movies that we saw back in the 80s.
Yeah.
There were lots of films like this.
Fifth Element.
That had this feel to them, like Time Bandits and Ice Pirates and all these kind of slightly, you know, straight to VHS type. Mad Max, even, you could say, had this kind of gritty urban look. I'm a bit tired of that. So for me, this thing just didn't fit together visually at all.
I mean, I agree with you, Joe, there, that the it's a little cliche that the poor people all look like they stepped off the set of Les Miserables, and the rich people are always shown hedonistically. I mean, you know, for once, there should be some thought put into, really, do rich people just hang around a disco cart and have some weird drugs and have, you know, orgies everywhere? Because that's kind of how it's portrayed, but
But isn't that how history has been? Isn't that what happened during the Second World War? Didn't you know?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't this what happened in Russia? Isn't this
I mean,
what
I did put during, this was like the storming of Versailles in yeah, some ways. You know, it's like the French Revolution.
This is exactly what was happening. I mean, I just find it, you know, I just find that it's so clever in terms of, maybe it is like a video game that they, you know, at some point people have had enough, and then they're going to start to revolt. And the Tilda Swinton character is so amazing. The Alison Pill character who plays the pregnant school teacher. Amazing. I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't think this is, I mean, all the movies you mentioned, Mad Max and The Fifth Element, they're all classics in my mind. And anything which kind of measures up to that is doing something very well.
That's not what I have the problem with. I mean, I like the idea of the social structure thing. It's just, I don't think it's especially original. And I think we've seen this kind of thing done before and again and again and again. So, for a movie which I think is trying to do something different, it doesn't achieve that for me.
Yeah, I mean, I want to go back to the Tilda Swinton character. You know, I think she's at risk because she's playing a quirky character, like she almost did in the Grand Budapest Hotel earlier this year, of being a little bit typecast. And initially I was thinking, gosh, you know, Tilda Swinton, you better be careful what you're doing. And she recently played a vampire in, you know, Only Lovers Left Alive. But then I started thinking about it, and I started thinking, actually, that character itself is one of the most genius characters because, and I don't know whether you guys picked up on this, but it felt to me like the reason that character is the way it is because she was actually a poor person that got plucked and picked and put with the rich people. But it's so subtle. It's such a subtle thing that you can miss it. And that's what created the genius for me. I was like, wow, okay, I get this.
And I also like the idea, as depraved as the final act of the movie is, it really gets into this piece where what if you're fighting the Great Revolution and then you're able to get to a place where you can, you know, you do a military coup almost, and you get to a place where now you can take the position of, you know, the tyrant. Would you do it? And this is, history has showed us that people who come, look what's happening right now in you know,
Israel and
Palestine. Look what's happening in coups, where the people who come with these very idealistic positions of, you know, I want to do better for my world, I'm going to bring down the horrible power mongers. Then when they do the coup and they're in the position of gaining power, they may take that, you know. So the whole corruption thing, I think, is very well realized. My single biggest problem with the movie was the bloodletting. I mean, in all the reviews that I've seen in the movie, nobody has mentioned how brutally violent this movie is. I mean, the bone crushing and the bloodletting.
It really was.
It's like all out massacre. And I even hesitate to say that because I don't want to take away from anybody who wants to watch the movie. But I really was unprepared for that. And that left a horrible taste in my mouth that I really couldn't get out.
I did feel dirty.
Yeah.
I felt physically dirty after I came out of the movie.
The other movie actually reminded me of was The Raid. From a year or two ago. Again, it was that whole leveling up concept where, you know, you have this series of battles that you have to get through. But yeah, it was incredibly violent.
Okay, let's wind this one up then. So Yazdi, why don't you go first?
So like I said before, this film is a strong, strong reminder to me of the value of handing over the reins of a movie to a person with vision and then getting the hell out of their way. I think those seeking real thrills and action this summer should seek out this film. Give me one splendid, ambitious, fully realized, bonkers movie than 10 lazy, empty Transformer films. I think this movie is a wonderful anomaly. Shame on the Weinstein brothers for not doing a better job with marketing it, because it's only playing in about two cinemas. I give it an 8.5 out of 10. The only reason, I mean, while I was watching it, I was sure it was going to be a 9. But the only reason why I bump it down is because of where it goes towards the end. 8 out of 10.
Joe?
So I think you'll glean from my comment, the biggest issue I have with this movie was not that I didn't enjoy it, because I think it was an enjoyable experience to watch. It's just I find it very hard to recommend that anyone go see it. I think there's very few people who I would say, you know, run out and see this one, run out and catch this one, because I don't know that it's a universally receivable type movie. So for that reason alone, I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10. I think it was full of some nice ideas, but it just ultimately felt like a retreading of many, many things that we've seen before. So, yeah, 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I would say it's probably recommendable for anyone who loves sci-fi, and doesn't matter what shape or form that sci-fi comes in. That's the sort of person who's going to like this movie. I have really mixed feelings about this movie. This pierced and riveted me for the first 3 quarters of it. And I would easily, Yazdi, like you, given it a 9 out of 10 if it had stopped at a certain point. But I had a really, it just had a really poor end. And the fact that it was a long movie with a really crappy end makes it a 2 out of 10 at the end. So I'm going to average and give it a 6 out of 10 overall.
The other thing I like about the movie is, you know, this is a Korean director who's only ever made Korean movies before. And I like that Tilda Swinton and Chris Evans is a Hollywood actor.
Yeah.
And Jamie Bell and John Hurt, you know, these are all international actors who kind of lined up, you know, because they believe this actor who happened to be making movies in another language. I wish there's a purity about it. I wish more actors did that. You know, you should work with the French director, you know, work with the Danish one if you think he's great.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on.
So our third movie of the week is Boyhood. It's going to be a challenge to try and talk about this one quickly because we're already half an hour into the podcast, but do bear with us because this movie was an epic movie. It's directed by one of our favorite directors, I think, on Movie Rollers, Richard Linklater. And he basically put this movie together over the course of 12 years by using the same cast. So he followed essentially a boy, I don't know how old he was at the beginning of the movie, but certainly 6 years old, so prepubescent young child. Follows him all the way through into young adulthood. And the movie does essentially follow him, hence the title Boyhood. But it also follows the family around him, played by Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke, who are his estranged parents. And Lorelei Linklater, who I think is Linklater's daughter, plays the guy's sister. So in a movie that I think is you know, unlike anything else that's made in terms of its breadth and scope. You know, it's made over 12 years, same cast. I'm really curious to see what you guys thought of it. It opened with huge recommendations from Sundance. It played at South by Southwest this year as well. And yeah, I'm just really curious to find out what you guys thought of the movie.
I mean, for me, this is a really great concept, and clearly this is a labor of love, but I think I found myself asking, was it a good movie, or was it good that we were seeing the same cast aging over 12 years? And so I think the fact that I was asking myself the question brings me to the realization that at its core, this is an average story with a brilliant gimmick that just manages to work. Of course it's going to be lifelike because you're watching the same cast over 12 years, and you're seeing the actors growing up, and you care about what happens to them. But if that's the case, why not just watch 56 and up? My point is, you may as well watch a documentary versus a movie, especially when the story is not real and it's actually not all that compelling.
Yes, Dee.
We saw this movie 3 days ago, and the movie hasn't left me since then. I think of all the movies in our generation that, you know, we may be seeing and talking about, this one might be the one which will most easily register to future generations as a classic. I think the way we talk about Casablanca right now, people will be talking about Boyhood in generations to come. And I'm really struggling not to use superlatives when I'm talking about this movie. But I think this is an important film. And I think the reason why it's important, I mean, I agree that its reason for being the way it's marketed, the way it's getting all the points, is because of this gimmick, if you will, about watching this child grow up on camera. But I think what personally makes it important is that how exquisitely unpretentious it is. And at every point in the movie, the director avoids saying anything particularly profound or important. And the movie seems to be constructed almost entirely of nothingness, of banalities, of little things happening. And then the most amazing things happen. And I think maybe it didn't for you, Rashmi, but for me, all those little things coalesced at the end and became something uniquely amazing. It became one of the most important things. I mean, it just added up to so much weight for me towards the end. Joe?
So I'm going to disagree with the point that you made about everything being almost trivial as you go through the movie, because I think Linklater is a modern day philosopher. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I like about all of his movies is that he has these lines of dialogue which question everything. I mean, the meaning of the mundane. If you watch the movie Slacker, that's a great example, I didn't like Slacker very much, I'll be honest with you. I thought it was full of these kind of banal type discussions that were really kind of sleep inducing. But I think now I can maybe want to go back and look at that movie again because I get it. Because I get what he is doing as a director. I understand his writing. And I think, you know, we have debates and discussions throughout the movies over really very trivial stuff. But actually, they go beyond that. They're about relationships. They're about the human condition. They're about existential stuff. And I think he really does a good job of capturing the feeling of growing up. More than anything, as I went through this movie, it reminded me of moments. And these really are just a series of moments from a person as they grew up. And you know, I think maybe I draw some similarities to the central character in terms of how I grew up and how the particular character grew up here. But it really felt like I was experiencing somebody growing up in a way that I hadn't experienced since my own growing up. Movies don't do this to me. This movie did.
Yeah, and I can see, you know, of course, this is Linklater, and I love Linklater, and there are moments of greatness, and there is great dialogue, but I just feel like the fact that he had to go back every year and film didn't necessarily have a story arc prepared. And so he kind of had to fit around how the characters were growing up and what they were doing in their life to kind of make it retrofit. And so,
well, there isn't really an arc to this. I mean, I think
exactly. And so
yes, you may disagree, so, but
right. So my whole point is, why is this any different to watching a reality show? If it's a good reality show, now come on, I know those two things are often not used in the same sentence. A good reality show, but I mean, 56 and up. Why not just watch that? Why is that any different? And why put it in a film format if nothing is going to actually happen?
Because this is scripted. So I think this is scripted. So I think the only piece that they worked around was, and I want to read more about this movie to find out, is about the character of, you know, the boy who grows up. I think they only worked out how he went to be, but everything else was scripted. The fact about what happens to his mom, the nature of her husband, you know, how his husband goes through a new incarnation, I think... even if this movie had nothing to do about the kid, I would have gladly watched what happens every year just to the character of the mother and the father, especially Patricia Arquette. She starts off being, in this film, somebody who is completely out of control and has no sense of her life. She has these kids very early in her life. She doesn't know what to do with it. To the point where she evolves, and towards the end of the movie, she's become somebody who is contributing to society. And she has educated herself. And from being a person who was kind of on the fringe of the society, now she's somebody who is defining that society. And I found that, and that's not something which happened. That's what was written into the story, to see this evolution. And I think this is where the genius of the movie lies. And I don't use the G word sparingly, or I do use it sparingly rather, is that the movie never makes a big deal about all of these things. It just lets all of these things layer on slowly. Mm-hmm. It never, ever at one point stops to make a big deal of Patricia Arquette's character. Or it never, ever stops to make a big deal of, you know, the Ethan Hawke character. I mean, he comes off initially as this, you know, drive-in father who shows up once in a while, almost making up with too many gifts for the fact that he's not there in their children's lives. And see what happens to him. I mean, he turns out to be, as the more you get to know him, the more he evolves as a human being, we understand this character so much more. So I, you know, Manola Dargis in her review of the New York Times said that, like, the best films, this one makes you think after you've seen it with shock that how come nobody ever thought to do this before? I mean, it's amazing that, you know, 100 plus years in the history of movies, it's the first time that somebody actually thought to follow a character over a period of time. And granted that Michael Apted's 7-Up series, which followed, like you said, the documentary, which followed these characters every 7 years, 7-Up, 14-Up, it's running right now at 58-Up or something. They did it, but that was a documentary. And I think for somebody to have the patience to build a script around these characters and essentially act around these two kids who are growing up, I think it's a risky experiment, but it's an experiment which ultimately works.
And to that, I would say, I don't know that it needed to be as experimental as it is. I mean, this is a very well-crafted script. So we could have done it by replacing the actor as the boy over the years. We could have done it with makeup and costume changes on the adult characters, and it would have still been a very effective movie. So I think it is somewhat gimmicky. You know, obviously he's a visionary and he wanted to create something that has greater depth in terms of how it looks and feels. You believe a lot of what you see because, you know, there are no anachronisms. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything is exactly the fashion and the period from which it comes. The TV, the video games, the way that people dress, the cars, everything. Everything fits perfectly. So you've got a very credible, coherent way of seeing that picture. But there's nothing here that I don't think could have been done kind of the standard Hollywood way and shot over a year instead of, you know, a 12-year period.
Right, and that's my point.
So it's a gimmick.
Yeah, so would you have enjoyed it as much if it hadn't been this gimmick of every year?
Yeah, because it didn't. Once I basically forgot about that once I was in the movie. Hmm. I mean, to me, it did play out like a traditional narrative. It didn't feel like a series of vignettes. It was a story. Maybe it didn't have a traditional arc of a story, but it was a story, and it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. For me, that was irrelevant, ultimately.
Mm. And I think that's the piece that didn't work for me.
But I think for me, that was one of the great... This is why I think this movie is important, is because I think it's one of the miracles of cinema to watch this character grow on film like this. Usually you have to go across somebody's... Like, you can watch a young Robert De Niro all the way to Robert De Niro now, and you'd have to clip through movies. But to watch this character... And I was so fascinated that this character of played by Ellery Coltrane in the movie, he starts off being a very happy kind of, you know, fun loving kid. And then as he's growing older, he becomes this sullen, he has a darkness about it. One of the characters in the movie mentions that there's a gloominess about him. And I don't think that's something they could have predicted. I don't think he's acting. I think that's how this kid has grown up. He's grown up to be
a sullen kid.
So do you think Linklater took the attributes of the actor and wrote around them? Because I think in terms of acting, the guy was really showing us who he was as opposed to the character on the page. You know, you don't know what kind of an actor this kid's going to be when they're six.
Right.
So does he then take the fact that this guy's a moody teenager and write around that? Is that what you think happened here?
No, I think he had a general script in terms of what happens to this kid, what happens when he grows up, what happens with his father, what happens when he goes to college, that kind of stuff. And, you know, the how different people in his life other than his parents influence him. I just love that. I mean, I, you know, like you, Rashmi, I watched this movie as a chronicle initially, like I was watching a documentary. And I laughed a few times. I smiled and I yawned a few times. It was at the end of a long day. This is a 3-hour movie. And, you know, towards the end, I was getting a little frustrated. Like, where is this big, messy, right, overstuffed, you know, thing of a movie, this documenta of this family? Where is it headed? And I had a little bit of anxiety around it. But the strangest thing happened is that there's an event which happens towards the end of the movie, and it's not a big event. But when it happened, I just had tears running down my eyes, and I wanted to stop, and I could not stop. You know, it so emotionally moved me because this overstuffed, seemingly randomly put together documenta somehow became analogous with my search for meaning in life. It had almost coalesced with what I am looking. And the movie seemed to me to come closest to define the nature of memories. This is how memories are. You remember a lot of my own life. I remember a lot about isolated events in my life. You know, I remember half an hour which had happened when I was 14, and I remember, you know, a week in my life, you know, when I was 11. And this movie kind of played out like that, and that's where the strength of the movie comes from, I think.
Yeah, and just to respond, Yasti, I mean, I think the reason he's a gloomy, you know, ends up being a gloomy kid in the end is look at the life he had. It wasn't a great life. I mean, it was full of bad parenting, and so yeah, I guess I didn't have the revelation at the end. I mean, I probably had the same journey as you, but no revelation at the end. So I think we are almost at the end of this podcast. So with that, anything more to say, or shall we start scoring?
I'm good to score.
Okay, Joe, go ahead.
So, I mean, this is a unique movie. It's unlike anything I've seen and unlike anything that I think I will see. I mean, Rashmi, to your point, it did evoke some thoughts about the 56 Up series. So I really admire what the director did here in terms of making it over a length of time. I think it was an enormous risk. I mean, anything could have happened to any of these actors, which have completely derailed this filmmaking.
Good point, yeah.
But nonetheless, the movie has a beautiful truth to it. It's life. Linklater understands life, and I think he's distilled it down to the pivotal moments that shape this boy's life. And to me, it really was like experiencing growing up again. Blown away by this. I it will stay with me for a long, 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 long time. 9 out of 10.
Wow. Yasti.
Yeah, like you said, Joe, I mean, this is what I think about this movie is, I mean, by the way, this movie has taken residence in my mind and it won't let go. I've been thinking about it constantly. And the funny part is I don't even want it to let go. I want to, you know, dwell on it. And actually, I cannot wait to watch this 3-hour movie about nothingness all over again.
Yeah.
Just in.
Let me know when you're going. I'll be there with you.
I mean, I too give this movie the rare 9 out of 10. And the funny feeling is I have a sense that I've only kind of felt the tip of the iceberg in this movie, that the more I think about it, the more I experience it, that I'm going to find more from it. And I do think it is that rare film which somehow, you know, it's so difficult without being cynical or obvious or pedantic or pandering to reflect life on screen. And this movie somehow miraculously manages to bottle everything up. And when I look back on this movie now, it seems to me of the nature of evenings and memories and life and answering the big unknowables. And so I hate to sound, you know, pretentious when I'm saying this, but this is what cinema can be. It's what a tremendous accomplishment. I love this film.
And Rashmi.
So clearly I watched a completely different movie, because all of those things that you said, Yasti, added up to a little bit lazy in my mind, because literally I felt like we were forced to watch nearly 3 hours of bad parenting and poor relationship choices again and again, and the impact they have on the children. For me, this is a don't rush out and see it. It is a gimmick. Save it for a long plane ride. That way you won't miss any of your boyhood or girlhood. 6 out of 10. Completely.
Do you think that's
lost.
A male-female perspective?
Possibly.
I mean, for me, it's felt like growing up as a boy. I mean, there were some very male coming-of-age moments in the movie that I related to.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up like this. I mean, I didn't have these parents, and I didn't grow up in Texas. And I, you know, but it seemed to me the things that all of those three characters were struggling with were things that to me resonated. They were universal. I mean, look, the whole movie is set in Texas, and look at, you know, he goes to meet his grandparents at one time, and there are these Bibles and guns kind
and
of
they're
Texas.
His step grandparents even.
if they're step grandparents, but there is no judgment on them. Link, it could have been so easy, and people will laugh when they want to, and people will, you know, politically it makes a statement about the Bush administration. It makes a statement about
Obama.
It's so many things, but the movie's never judging. It's just saying this is how this character feels. This is how these people live, and I think it's so much more difficult, right, to do that than to just make a cheap joke out of.
Yeah.
These people who give him a Bible for his birthday. I mean, that should have played cheap, but it actually...
No, there was a sincerity there.
It moved me. And, you know, yeah.
I don't disagree with you. I just think that the depth didn't have an impact on me the same way it did on both of you, so...
Is that a wrangle?
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah, maybe that's a wrangle. So check back on our website for the wrangle. We will set up a wrangle to go with one of these three movies.
Yeah, okay. Sounds good. All right, mail at movierollers.com, twitter.com/movierollers, facebook.com/movierollers as well. Do interact with us. We'd love to know what you thought of these movies. And sorry, it's been a long podcast today. I hope it's been worth your while. Three interesting movies to talk about. So we did go on a little longer than usual. But until our next episode, it is too many movies, too little time. Hey, goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.